Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. This is Theology Thursday. Typically, we look at the news of the day from a Christian worldview. Today, we look at the source of the Christian worldview, God's Word. Genesis 20:12 tells us that Abram and Sarah were brother and sister, half brother and sister. Okay. Well, did he lie to Pharaoh then, since she was his sister? Yes, he did lie. He did lie. His purpose was to deceive him into thinking that they were not married. That was his purpose. And sometimes your lie might have a smattering of truth to it, maybe just to help you tell it with a straight face, or maybe to make it sound even more plausible if somebody checks into it. And sometimes kids, when they grow up, you have to teach them to tell the truth. You don't have to teach them to lie. They figure that out automatically. And they'll even figure out, if I make my lie sound true by putting some truth into it, more likely somebody's going to buy it. So people will put truth in a lie. And half-truths are more deceptive than blatant truths normally. So this was a deception. And through this deception, Abram really put his wife at risk. But I don't want to take that next step and say, so we know that all lying is wrong, that all lying suggests a lack of trust in God. I don't want to take that step because that is an incorrect step. Not all lying is wrong. Deception generally is bad. It's sinful. And God wants us to tell the truth, and especially, for example, in court, do not commit perjury. Do not bear false witness against your neighbor. That would be a sin. If your neighbor's falsely accused and you're lying, that would be a sin. But how about lying for good reasons? Is it possible to lie for a good reason? Yes, it is. Is it possible to rape for a good reason? No. It's not possible to rape for a good reason. It's not possible to murder for a good reason. Now, it's possible to kill for a good reason, as the Bible shows, for example, in self-defense, but it's not possible to murder for a good reason, and it's not possible to rape, but it is possible to lie for a good reason. Examples in the Bible. In the very next book, Exodus chapter 1, Pharaoh says to the Hebrew midwives, if there's a baby girl born to the Jews, let her live, but a baby boy, kill the boy. And so they feared God, and they refused to obey Pharaoh. So they disobeyed the government, for one. And then Pharaoh called them in and said, what's going on? And what did they do? Did they break down and say, we can't obey you, Pharaoh, because our God said, don't murder? They could have done that, but it probably wouldn't have been wise. Because for one, they may have been killed on the spot for disobeying Pharaoh. And two, whoever their replacements would be would probably just kill the male children. So they lied to Pharaoh, and they said, you know, we really try, but the Hebrew women are different than the Egyptian women. The Egyptian women, they're pregnant, they take forever, slow, out of the baby, takes hard. But the Hebrew women, out, baby's out, before we even get there. And Pharaoh, nobody ever said that the Canaanites were especially intelligent. Well, he was a descendant of Ham through Mizraim in Egypt, and he apparently bought the silly lie, and they stayed in his good graces, so they saved lives. And God tells us that he blessed them abundantly because of how they deceived and disobeyed Pharaoh. So if you're going to lie to save a life, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. We don't have to go much further in Israel's history, just to the book of Joshua, which is the first book after the five books of Moses. And in Joshua chapter 2, the Israelites were soon to take the city of Jericho, and this harlot there, Rahab, ran into these Hebrew spies, Joshua and Caleb. Am I getting the story right? And she hid them. She hid them, and the king of Jericho came and said, "Hey, where are those Israelites? We know they're here." And she said, "No, they were here. You're right. But they left, and it's late, so if you hurry up," they went down there, up the hill, "chase them, and you'll get them." And the king and all his men went out after them, but she was lying. They were on her roof hiding. That was some lie. And God promised her he would bless her. And there's a Rahab in the genealogy of Jesus Christ. That woman was blessed by God because of her lie. She lied to defend innocent blood, to protect innocent people from slaughter by the wicked. God blesses that. God doesn't wrestle with that up in heaven. "Oh no, what am I going to do? She did a good thing, but she had a lie to do it. No, God just blessed her. Because it should be clear to anyone who knows right from wrong, that situation, it should be on the surface clear that these people are doing a good thing when they lie. When Christians wrestle with this kind of thing, it shows that they're not clearly seeing righteousness. They are clouded with legalism. And the law becomes of a higher authority than God himself. Jesus Christ said that God did not make men for the law. He made the law for man. So if you disobey the law in order to save a life, that's a good thing to do. Even in this country, even with our laws as perverted as they are, if it says no trespassing, but you have to break in to save a baby from a fire, that's not like a difficult situation. "Oh no, what do? We got to punish him, but we give him a reward too." No, you don't have to punish him. He didn't do a bad thing. He did a good thing. And it wasn't doing a good thing in a bad way. It was only a good thing. And there was nothing about it that was bad. But when we are mired in legalism, when we end up worshiping the rules, liberals worship rules, and that is a truth that if you catch on to that for the rest of your life, you'll understand liberals. Liberals worship rules. Then we will understand how liberalism creeps into the body of Christ. And then we end up elevating the rules above God and his righteousness. Remember, with Ai, the city of Ai, after they took Jericho so mightily, then there's this little dinky place, Ai. Remember Abram camped between Bethel and Ai? Right? So they go to Ai, and here's this dinky little village, and they figure, piece of cake. And they go in there, and they get routed. The men of Ai come out chasing them and kill a few dozen Israelites, and they're scared to death. Because now, not only this little village of Ai routed us and chased us, but now the word's going to get out all through the land that we're vulnerable. And there are cities a lot bigger than Ai. And God came and instructed them. You know, they went off on their own steam, with their own flesh. And God had to reprove them. And you have to do it God's way, not your way. So what was God's way for the Israelites to take Ai? Do you remember what he did? In Joshua chapter 8, the whole chapter, God says, "I want you to lay an ambush for the city. I want you to take 5,000 men and go in between Bethel and Ai. Hide there." And that's right where Abram camped. Right? That's where he built the altar, between Bethel and Abram. Take 5,000 men, go behind Ai, and then Joshua, you and the rest of the army, approach the city. When they come out to battle with you, run like a bunch of cowards. Run and let all the men, and it said all the men were so encouraged. We're routing them again. And every last man came out of the city to chase them. And when all the men left, then the 5,000 would attack the city and burn it. And then as soon as the Israelites saw the flames, they were encouraged. They turned on them. And the other guys stopped and they looked back. They saw their city burning. They had nowhere to run. And it was a slaughter and a military victory for these wicked Canaanites. And we saw earlier where the Canaanites came from. and why they were the most cursed of all the people on the earth, and how evil they were, and how God went to fight the battle in the heart of the enemy's camp. That's why they were in among the Canaanites. And these people were doing the vilest things, as we know, sacrificing their children to their false gods and many equally wicked things. So that was a lie. That was a lie that God told Joshua to tell. That was a lie. It wasn't a verbal lie, but it was a lie that was expressed through actions. Make believe they're winning and run, but really they're not winning. You're going to slaughter them. And 12,000 people were killed that day based on that lie that God orchestrated. Warfare is all about deception. And if it is a just war, for example, if one country attacks another and is stealing their land or killing their women and children, plundering that country, then it's a just thing to repel that invasion. And in the process of repelling that invasion, you don't think, oh, I have to be truthful. I can't deceive the enemy. That wouldn't be very Christian. No, that's so ignorant. And if you read long enough, you come across Christians who wrestle with these dilemmas. Is it right to be deceptive on D-Day? Is it right to build false tanks or whatever? So silly. Okay. There's a lot of examples. I'll give one other. David's wife, Michal, if that's... anybody know how to pronounce her name? I've never heard it pronounced. M-I-C-H-A-L. Looks sort of like Michael, but I don't like calling his wife Michal. So I'll call her Michal or Mickey. David's wife, Mickey, was also Saul's daughter. And Saul and David ended up bad blood between them. Saul's fault, not David. And so Saul wanted to kill David. David was married to his daughter. So he sent his men to their house and to see if he was there. And she said, she took a statue and put it in the bed, covered it up, said, David's sick. He can't go to the king. So they went and looked in, and David was sick. So they left. And Saul, and they said, we couldn't bring him because he was sick. Saul said, you bring him here in his bed so I could kill him. Bring his whole bed here. So they went back and found the statue in the bed, and Saul called his daughter and said, what did you do? Why did you deceive me and let my enemy escape? And she said, and that was one lie. The statue in the bed was a lie. And she told another lie right on the spot. She said, I had to do it or he would have killed me. So that was a lie too. But Saul was a murderous madman at this time. And so deceiving him was a very good thing to do. A very good thing to do. The hiding place. Corrie Ten Boom, her sister Betsy. Folks here have read the book or seen the movie? Yeah, a lot of yes. Great, great story. There are so many stories, not in the numbers there should be, but there are many hundreds of stories that history is now gradually revealing where people did extraordinary things to save some of the victims of the Holocaust, a Jewish child here on a farm, a whole family here in a city. And they saved many people and were heroes because of it and great Christians. The only sad thing in that story is how they wrestled with having to lie to the Nazis. They were like in turmoil. I had to lie again. It was so terrible. No, it wasn't terrible. And what is that a reflection of? It's a reflection of the general Christian attitude, how we elevate the rules above righteousness. That's a reflection of that. In Psalm 105, we read about this event where Abram and Sarai ended up in Egypt. I'll read you just a few verses. Psalm 105, verse 9, talks about the covenant that God made with Abram and his oath to Isaac, and confirmed it to Jacob for a statute to Israel as an everlasting covenant, saying, to you I will give the land of Canaan as the allotment of your inheritance. when they were few in number, indeed very few, strangers in it, when they went from one nation to another, from one kingdom to another people, God permitted no one to do them wrong. Yes, he rebuked kings for their sakes, saying, do not touch my anointed ones and do my prophets no harm. So God said, do not touch my anointed ones. And sure enough, he protected Sarai, who would be the woman who would birth the nation of Israel, Abraham being the father of Israel. So Pharaoh let them go, Abram and all his goods, all his household, even the gifts that Pharaoh gave to Abram. God even told his men, let him take it all. Just get them out of here. And whatever testimony Israel may have had eventually on Egypt, they sure blew it at this point right off the bat, right? The deception, Pharaoh's household is plagued. They would be neighbors geographically. And perhaps, even though it's against all likelihood in human nature, perhaps there were times like Nebuchadnezzar or the Queen of the South or others who would come from afar because they heard about Israel's God. And perhaps Egypt may have had a change of heart toward the true God, the Creator. But right off the bat, their first dealings with Israel was very negative. And certainly Pharaoh and Egypt did not have a good impression of these Israelites. We're calling them Israelites even before Jacob was born. Jacob, whom God named Israel, that's where we get the Israelite nation from. But we can call Abram an Israelite because he's the father of that nation. Okay, so he left Egypt, and this sad story is the second disappointing episode in Abram's life. In Isaiah chapter 43, verse 27, it says, your first father sinned, and your mediators have transgressed against me. God says, your first father sinned. In other words, you guys always sin. You're always sinning, not only Israel, the whole world, but even in Israel. You sinned, your father sinned. Like Stephen said, you guys killed the Messiah, but you persecuted those who foretold of the Messiah. So of course you persecuted the Messiah. And in Isaiah 43, God says, your first father sinned. He probably meant Abraham. Noah, he could have meant. Adam, he could have meant. But Abram, too. In the Bible, you could almost taste the flavor of realism. It doesn't candy coat the lives or the reputations of its personalities, like other religious books. Think about Adam and Noah, Abram now, Jacob, the things he did, the 12 patriarchs, and how despicable they behaved. So many of them, even selling their own brother into slavery. They're going to murder him. No, wait, we'll get some money out of the deal. Pretty bad. Moses did some terrible things. The second time God said, I'm going to give the people meat for a month, he said, yeah, right. What are you going to do? Bring all the flocks and the herds of the whole earth here to this desert? You bring all the fish of the sea right here? That's what Moses was saying to God. We cover that in the plot manuscript, chapter 10. Details galore. But how about Aaron, Moses' brother? How bad he was. And David, real bad. Get into the New Testament. Peter really blew it on occasion. Paul had to call him a hypocrite, and he denied Christ after seeing so many miracles. Of course, that's what miracles tend to do to believers. They tend to make their faith weak, which is the opposite of what a lot of people think. But in the plot, we've listed every miracle we can identify in the whole Bible in a chart. And many of you have seen that miracles do not strengthen someone's faith, because faith is the evidence of things not seen. And when people see a miracle, it's uncanny how the more miracles they see, the less they trust God. It's just uncanny. But that's one of the themes of the entire Bible from beginning to end. Well, the Bible presents its major personalities as really sinful and discouraging. You read through the Old Testament and you think, this is the most pitiful story I've ever read. How could you have so many failures in one book? Every generation, every episode, every event, it's one failure after another. That's the flavor of realism. If the Bible's just a book that some nation made up because they wanted to start a religion, why would they put all their failures in it? Why wouldn't they put all the lies that say how great they are in it? But they didn't do that. God is great and they are evil. That's the story of the Bible. And the contrast is stark when it comes to Jesus Christ, because he is the one human being in the whole Bible whom there's nothing evil to say about, who never sinned, who was only righteous. And why would the writers of the Bible, if all the big characters are evil, and they were writing this book for centuries, why would all of a sudden one guy be without sin? It's that flavor of realism in the Bible because the story is true and because Jesus Christ is the Creator God, the Son of God. Chapter 13, verse 1. Then Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him to the south. It's sort of funny that it says he went up from Egypt to the south, but that's the Negev, the south of Israel. So he went up from Egypt, north from Egypt, to the south, to the southern part of Israel. Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and in gold. Unlike Jesus, right, 2,000 years later, that we saw that he wasn't very rich materially, but Abram was. And he went on his journey from the south as far as Bethel, remember, which is about 5 miles north of Jerusalem, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai. So he came back to his homestead. The first place he pitched his tent, and then he was apparently there until the famine. Then he headed off to Egypt. He had that somewhat disastrous journey, although he did end up with more material wealth at the end of it. But then he's going back to Canaan. Where is he going to go? He goes back to that one place, even though he's still in a foreign land, that one place he could think of as home. He went back home, right into the heart of the enemy camp, right between Bethel and Ai. The same place, just coincidentally, where God said to Joshua, lay an ambush. Lay an ambush between Bethel and Ai and destroy the city of Ai. And that was what God had sent Abram to the promised land for. He sent him there because God plans to destroy the wicked and to build a promised land for those who repent. That's God's plan. And God destroying the wicked is not just an Old Testament aspect of God. That's the New Testament. It's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And the book of Revelation talks about many millions of people who God will destroy in his wrath. So, verse 4, he went to the place of the altar which he had made there at first, and there Abram called on the name of the Lord. And there might have been a prolonged period of Abram operating in his own strength, with his own wisdom, apart from the guidance of God when he went to Egypt. Because now he comes back to the altar, and it says, and there he called on the name of the Lord, suggesting that perhaps for the previous months in Egypt, he had stopped doing that. Colossians 3:15, Paul says, let the peace of God rule in your hearts. It's so important to ask God for guidance, wisdom, and direction. And you're planning something in your life, and there may not be a right or wrong. There just might be a wise choice and a somewhat less wise choice. And when you seek God, you get wisdom. Not that God magically imparts some kind of spirit dust in your brain, now you're smarter or your IQ has gone up, but just the exercise of seeking God for wisdom It's like exercising, lifting weights. It builds your muscles. And asking God for wisdom or direction builds your faith in God and puts your own perspective of your own abilities apart from God. It makes that clear. It reinforces, I can only succeed with the Lord. So Lord, please give me your wisdom and direction. In verse 5, Lot also, who went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. Now the land was not able to support them that they might dwell together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. The Canaanites and the Perizzites then dwelt in the land. And these Perizzites, they're not mentioned in the Table of Nations earlier in Genesis, and they're probably the descendants of Ham through Canaan. During Solomon's time, they were still around, and they were forced to become slaves in Israel. And during Ezra's time, some were still identifiable, and they married, they intermarried, which was, of course, in disobedience to God. And maybe future discoveries will help further clarify their identity, but they were most likely sons of Canaan, sons of Ham. So Abram said to Lot, please let there be no strife between you and me and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brethren. In a ministry or a church, sometimes you get to the point where there are disagreements, and it takes wisdom to know how to handle the disagreement. You might be wrong, and the person you're arguing with, you might be right, and they might be wrong, or vice versa, but how are you going to respond? And if you're disagreeing with a Christian over a tactic or a strategy, or whether how the church should grow or a Bible study, you become arch enemies over it. That would probably be very unwise. If there's a disagreement that can't be dealt with, well, let's both continue our ministries in different ways, maybe in different locations. You build a church in North Denver, we'll build one in South Denver. You try to win over the Democrats and we'll go after the Sodomites, whatever. Don't come to blows among Christians because there are disagreements or tensions. It would be so great if we could resolve each disagreement and if there could be unity and love and commitment that rises again above petty disagreements. But because of one party or the other or both, that often doesn't happen. And so when that doesn't happen and there are difficulties, God will still, even in that situation, give us wisdom to know how to deal with it in a way that's survivable. We don't have to end up every absolute disagreement destroying relationships. So I'd like to stop it right there, and we will have fun as we continue through Abram's life in the book of Genesis. God bless you all.